Good morning. That's lame. Try that one more time. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, that's so much better. It's good to be with you all today. I'm going to say in advance that this talk is going to be more of a chunk of a history lesson, probably a history lesson that I would venture to say most people have not had before, but I think it's important if we're going to really understand why we need to talk about race and racism in the nation state together. And we'll have some time for some more stream of consciousy reflections at the end, but hoping that we can talk together in the spirit of Occupy rather than me telling you exactly what I think needs to happen. I certainly have my opinions on the matter, that we can talk together. So we will jump right in. I apologize for mispronouncing any and all French names, and just bear with me as we motor through. So race, racism, and the nation state. Race, the method of classifying human beings based on biological differences, is, as most people know, a science fiction. Yet it remains entrenched in our language, our institutions, and our societies. How is it possible that systems of racial power and privilege continue to strangle societies across the globe when race is a defunct biological construct? In light of the work of other scholars and my own research around this question, I have come to see the social organization known as the nation state as one of the primary ongoing proponents of racism. So what follows is a presentation on this assertion in three parts. Part one, race theorizing, a historical overview, which will provide a sketch of racial theory making between the 17th and 19th centuries. Part two, race and nation building, which will look specifically at three of many areas to choose from, in which racial and racist discourse shape the very construction of what we know as the nation state. And part three, race moving forward, propositions and conversations, which will include a few, as I said, stream of consciousness thoughts on my part as to why knowing this history is important to this group and to anyone seeking liberation and justice for all God's people. So we get into it. In terms of early race theories, phase one, historians credit French physician François Bernier with first categorizing the diverse peoples he encountered on his extensive travels. In his 1684 paper, he counts, quote, four or five species or races of men based on people's facial features, hair texture, build, skin, and other traits, and speculates that the differences between the people he sees could be used as, quote, the foundation for a new division of the earth. Bernier's categories included Indians and Egyptians grouped with Europeans because, quote, those individuals take care of themselves and are not obliged to expose themselves so often as the lower class and are not darker than many Spaniards. So his categories show that, already we see what's going on here. His categories show that from the beginning, race reflects traditional aristocratic assumptions about proper behavior and prejudices toward the lower class. So you can't really have, I mean, we attempt to, and I think for good reason, but you can't have a good discussion about race without integrating class. And we'll see integrating other social locations as well. So in dividing humanity in this way, Bernier broke with the standard travel literature of his time and with the traditional view of history as a biblical genealogy. Biblical literalism was actually kind of a mediating factor against some of the rising racial theories because folks were trying to say, wait a minute, if we are all from Adam and Eve, we can't be doing all of this other stuff. So yay for biblical literalism in the 17th century. His divisions did not conflict with the prevailing cosmopolitan humanism of his time, which presumed still that all people could become rational, intelligent beings as long as you gave them the proper education and training. And the cosmopolitan humanism of that time also understood differences between human populations as the result of climate or geography. As part of the overall idealism and spirit of brotherhood within the Enlightenment, the vast majority of racial ideology between 1750 and 1850, quote, upheld the descent of all races from a single original group. Nevertheless, early detractors of this optimistic view argued that other races developed from the slow and steady decline of an original white race, so we already start seeing some shifts. Some detractors rejected equality among the races and began to advance a polygenesis view of racial origins. And we get a shift from race being a matter of climate or geography to race being something innate and biological within the people who bear a certain racial category. So we move then to a second phase of race theories in transition. Over time, race theories grew increasingly intolerant and more complex as they moved into the second phase of development. This paradigm shift was already apparent in 1850 when anatomist Robert Knox asserted that, quote, race is everything. Literature, science, art, in a word, civilization depends on it. In The Races of Men, his book, he argued that race is biological, it's hereditary, and it's unalterable by external stimuli. All the traits exhibited by a person or group, from their intelligence or physical build, to their morality, to their definition of government, to their definition of liberty, all of these things were determined by race. Knox not only challenged what he saw as the flawed racial theories of his peers, he also advanced new hypotheses. So he divided Bernier's groups and Blumenbach's groups, another thinker, he divided their racial categories into more distinct subspecies and rejected the idea of a singular European race. So in his view, Saxons, Celts, Negroes, Americans, Hottentots, Jews, these were all distinctive biological racial specimens. Because each race was its own self-contained species, he strongly opposed interracial marriage and reproduction as detrimental and unsustainable, and did not think any race could survive when relocated outside of their original climate. Knox described what he called a quote-unquote physiological law that destined people composed of two or more races to eventual extinction, since prolonged racial mixing would make those groups increasingly infertile. In a move that became increasingly popular among early theorists, Knox also used race to reimagine European history. So he reconceived, for example, the Canadian conflict between France and Britain as a war between the Celt and Saxon races, respectively. He imagined the Celts as a race with a furious fanaticism, a love of war and disorder, a hatred for order and patient industry. Meanwhile, the tall, powerful, athletic Saxons were natural democrats with the best understanding of liberty. I hope there's no Celts and Saxons in the audience. In his view, the Saxons' innate independent spirit made them dislike the proximity of a neighbor and compelled them to broaden their territory. And so given these racial distinctions between the groups and the natural law that prohibited racial mixing, Knox saw the contest for Canadian territory as an unavoidable race war in which unity was impossible and peace could only be achieved through one group's total annihilation. So more than a model for classifying observable human differences, which is kind of the first sort of phase, race was also becoming an ideological tool for segregating countries and their residents, for explaining and naturalizing cultural and social differences, for justifying military conflict and conquest over one another. The polygenesis biologically determinative racial hypothesis was winning the day, and the implications were becoming more socially oppressive. So we skip happily into the age of modern racism. In this third phase of modern racism, racial theories were becoming more sophisticated, more widespread, and more totalizing as white Europeans became more anxious about their racial makeup and the threat of racial degeneration became more pervasive. So anything, alcoholism, tuberculosis, venereal disease, a lack of physical training, sexual perversion, all of these things are signs that, oh my gosh, our race is under attack from within, we're going to become biologically extinct, we have to do something about it, like yesterday. In Hereditary Genius, a book by author and thinker Francis Galton, he attempted to prove his view that intelligence, physical strength, and other personal traits were inherited, and that no amount of education or training could overcome one's natural limitations. Furthermore, he believed that modernity's demand for greater centralization, greater communication, a more sophisticated culture also required more intentional racial management. One of his proposals for increasing the intelligence, creativity, and abilities of his race was encouraging the stronger members to marry and procreate faster than the weaker ones. And he also advocated integrating, quote, eminently desirable refugees into the society from other places and relocating undesirable people to the colonies. Shirking either of these responsibilities would, quote, cause the race of the prudent to fall and bring utter ruin upon the breed. Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species, even though this was not what he was writing about, would radically transform racial scholarship as thinkers appropriated the theory of evolution to explain how superior and inferior races develop. For quite a while, people were pretty sure there was a hierarchy between the races, but nobody really knew how, and then Darwin's thing became kind of handy in explaining the how. In particular, racial thinkers applied the ideas of natural selection to human relationships and imagined a world in which people from different classes, races, and cultures were locked in an inescapable but necessary battle for survival and supremacy. So by the late 19th century, what was called, or what historians call, social Darwinism and the study of eugenics, the pseudoscience of improving racial bloodlines so that superior groups could speedily prevail over lesser ones, was spreading across Europe and the US. So that's a very cursory overview of kind of the first thinkings around race and where we end up. I wrote a 40-page paper on this. There's a lot of missing quotes. So that if people have questions, I can fill in some blanks. So we move to the kind of second part of race and nation building. How are all of these theories kind of interacting with this unfolding thing called the nation state? As racial theorizing developed, it became integral to the ideological and institutional project of nation building. This project involved using state power as well as emerging social institutions to tightly regulate citizenship, foster common identity and solidarity among disparate groups, create defined geographic borders to separate insiders and outsiders, and manage people who live within and attempt to enter ever-restricted national boundaries. Race was also useful for explaining the consequences of rapid modernization, such as greater competition in domestic and international affairs, increased militarization, geographic expansion, tightening territorial controls, and economic turmoil. And so you see one of the parts that I left out here that I think is incredibly interesting is how race is used to deal with issues of class and the emerging class divide. You have criminologists who are like, you know, people who commit crimes, they're actually not people. They're a subspecies, they're not quite human, they come from beasts. Those are some of the people we have to relocate to the colonies. It's used to redirect from the fact that, oh, emerging capitalism might be really terrible, to it must be a problem with these, a biological problem with these people that they can't seem to be integrated and fit into the society that's emerging. I left that part out, but there are the three particular examples I want to look at are race's role in naturalizing the nation, in determining citizenship, and in maintaining national borders. So naturalizing of the idea of the nation. As the Romantic period supplanted the Age of Enlightenment, race theorizing was integrated into calls for, quote, the state to be driven by common purpose of a people, sharing a common ancestry and thus a single destiny. Thinkers across Europe who adhered to social Darwinism wrote treatises demonstrating that the blood of the people would determine the rise or the fall of the state. So, for example, social Darwinist Carl Pearson described the ideal nation as, quote, an organized whole kept up to a high pitch of internal efficiency by ensuring that its numbers are substantially recruited from the better stocks, as well as kept up to a high pitch of external efficiency by contest, chiefly by war with inferior races, struggle for trade routes, and struggle for sources of raw material and food supply. In addition to his theory of racial degeneration, there was an author by the name of Gobineau who saw race and nation as natural extensions of one another. He argued that although mismanaged racial mixing could be civilization's downfall, selective racial mixing was essential to the rise of civilization. So there are disputes around whether racial mixing is going to kill us all, or if you do it right, you can get the right mix and keep your kind of country or your nation running at a superior kind of level. In his view, superior European races had a natural tolerance for interbreeding that darker and lesser races lacked, allowing the former to build more advanced societies. Although racial mixing between even high-grade pairings would eventually dilute the group's power across generations, the slow decline was also necessary to form new social institutions and customs. So he's positing a very kind of complex racial theory here where you don't want to racial mix bad, you want to make racial mix good. You're probably going to decline anyway, but on the way, really creative things will happen, and then your nation will end up being really, really cool. I mean, that's the 2012 distillation, as it were. According to historian Ivan Hannaford, he's the author of a book, Race, The History of an Idea in the West, quote, what burst upon the scene from 1842 and 1859 was a movement that treated political activity as subject to the same rules of evolution that applied to the natural biological world. And so you had a crop of negative eugenicists who called on the state to stop interfering in the evolutionary process, just allow the inferior races to go extinct. To accomplish this goal, these racial theorists recommended ending social services for the weak and curtailing their reproductive capacity through sterilization and castration. In 1919, a cluster of European nations actually began passing some of these negative eugenics laws, premarital examination laws, sterilization laws aimed at maintaining racial purity. Although many leaders privately sympathized with this negative eugenics approach, government intervention often leaned more toward positive eugenics, and that emphasized strengthening the strong members of the society. Don't worry about the weak ones, they'll disappear anyway. What we need to do is focus on the strongest among us. And so by the year 1880, various eugenics campaigns and programs throughout Europe encouraged couples with the best racial stock to procreate. They held women responsible for birthing the next generation of racially superior soldiers, colonizers, and leaders. They developed laws to, get this, regulate maternity leave. We like maternity leave. Where does maternity leave come from? And food hygiene. We like food hygiene, too. Laws to restrict child and female labor. and the institution of compulsory education and school nutrition programs. These things kind of emerge out of a very murky racial nation-building soup. And so it's important to think about that. In an effort to outpace the growth of racial threats, quote, the state assumed ever-increasing powers to intervene within the private sphere of the family and to maximize reproductive power. So the naturalization of the nation state. The other part that I want to focus, the intersection between racism and the nation state, is in determining citizenship. So as fear and panic over supposed signs of racial degeneration spread and international competition increased, emerging nations sought to preserve and enhance their strength by limiting the social and political influence of weaker races. So in 1858, good old Abraham Lincoln publicly argued against allowing black races to be political and social equals with whites. And despite his rejection of slavery, he was not interested in making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. He even explored the possibility of colonizing black people outside the United States. Even though Lincoln sort of originally softened his original position on voting toward the end of the Civil War, this shift did not mean that he believed all Negroes could be citizens. There's an 1864 correspondence between him and the governor of Louisiana where he sort of asks, well, can the very intelligent and those who have participated in military service Negroes at least be able to vote? We don't want everybody, but can those groups? After the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation, Southern states continued disenfranchising the Negro race on the grounds that they had been, quote, excluded as a separate class from all civilized governments and the family of nations, end quote. Although Congress tried to enforce Negro citizenship, economic turmoil in the South and racism in the North fostered mass disenfranchisement using tactics that we might be familiar with, poll taxes, literacy tests, property restrictions, and grandfather clauses. There's a really interesting quote in Racism, A Short History, where George M. Fredrickson suggests that it's this weird irony that because the nation is committed to equal rights for all citizens, it ironically leads to social Darwinist racism thriving in America. And what he says is that if you're on the one hand making the argument that all people should be able to participate in the political system, you have to have a really good reason why certain groups of almost people shouldn't be able to participate in the system. And so if you can make a biological argument that these people will ultimately lead to the downfall of your civilization, then you can still retain your, hey, all people should be able to participate, and well, but those sort of, we're not sure about them, they might kill us all, they should not be able to participate. Nation builders also excluded Jews from citizenship because of their inferior racial status and their perceived threat to the nation's purity. Because Jews lacked an easily recognizable trait like skin color, there was a lot of paranoia around Jewish participation in the nation. People feared them as the dangerous race within that could spread diseases, pollute the blood of superior races, gain political and economic control, and otherwise undermine the society covertly. And so nation builders also believed that Jews were nomads who had no roots or sense of belonging, and so you didn't want a nation within a nation to kind of thwart your big national project. And Jews fell into that category. So who gets to be a citizen within your nation is also very predicated early on, and I would say continually by racial discourse. And the third kind of section I'll look at here is maintaining borders. Just as race determined which residents could be citizens of the nation, race also decided which foreigners could reside within the nation's borders. And so according to the author of Racism, A Beginner's Guide, quote, "It was not before the full consolidation of the nation state that the right to enter and stay in a country became a legal matter. Borders were relatively free." And then all of a sudden, when this sort of paranoia about racial degeneration crops up, you get more people making relocation and movement an issue of legal concern. So said differently, immigration law is a distinctly modern construction that arose out of 19th century panic over racial degeneration, the ascendance of social Darwinism and eugenics, and international competition for economic, geographic, and especially racial power. America developed its first immigration laws in response to the influx of Chinese labor that flowed into California and other Western states. By the 1870s, resistance to Chinese immigration culminated in public protests and even several lynchings. And so that led to some legal moves in 1882, 1888, and 1889 that practically denied all Chinese people from entering the nation. So although resistance to Chinese immigration was actually rooted in economics, particularly inequalities within the American system, it was the language and concept of racial and national decline and fear of those prospects that led to scapegoating of the Chinese people. I think one of the things that's for maintaining borders, I think one of the things that for me as I was doing this research, you could kind of see, oh wow, it doesn't really seem that we've moved terribly far from some of these situations. What it drives me crazy when people say we're having a debate about immigration. We are not having a debate about immigration. People from Paris, people from London, people from Sweden, people from, you know, whatever else, they can come here without a problem. We're having a debate about whether or not certain brown people are going to pollute our national status to the point where it's going to make us ineffective. So let's be honest about those kinds of things. So I've been told I got 3 minutes. I'll try to do my rambly stuff very quickly. So what's the point of rehashing all of this not-so-ancient history? Why is this trip down memory lane important for a gathering of this kind? First, I believe that in order for the body of Christ to be as effective as possible in participating in God's mission of justice, liberation, and reconciliation for human creation, at least, the church needs to actually understand what it is we're up against. Although there are many resources about racism and many resources about the ills of the state, there are less resources explaining how the two systems hold together. I think this lack of knowledge weakens our ability to creatively and carefully work at healing the painful and deep wounds caused by our racialized socio-political systems. So to illustrate the point in another way, if a pastor with any wisdom stumbled upon a serious conflict between two members of her congregation, she probably would not begin to try and solve the crisis without at least first discerning the nature of the conflict as best she could. And yet often well-meaning Christians create communities for committees for racial healing or jump into solidarity projects in neighborhoods with people of color or convene circles to discuss racial hurts, etc. We do pulpit exchanges without understanding the depth of the problem that we are entering into. And not only is this a peculiar way to approach something as complex and harrowing like race, it's also a surefire way to create plans and processes that frustrate, lie dormant, and do not actually help us live out the Pentecost in a sustained way. I think people in general, but especially in the church, need a different narrative around race and racism that is actually honest. Although most Christians I hang around are able to see why racism is bad, I have also found that they don't always have a robust understanding of how racism functions beyond the interpersonal, much less how it functions in tandem with something as influential in the world as empire. So the popular discourse around race is we need to build more personal relationships, we need to find more ways to get along, we need to appreciate one another's cultural practices and ethnic foods, we need to apply the golden rule. And similarly, the common discourse about the nation state tends to be that we need it to establish order, to keep us from harming one another, and to look out for the common good. But I think in my research, what I've seen is that it isn't the case that the nation state is simply straying from its best self when it institutes and practices racist policies. Instead, it is living out its most basic assumptions. And so when the church doesn't recognize, when the church doesn't recognize, or worse yet, is completely ignorant of these dynamics, it is easy to get stuck in what I'm calling for this time, preaching to the choir political non-activism, in which we write our senator and say, Senator so-and-so, this immigration law is really racist. Please don't do that. We march around and we fight this war. Oh my gosh, that's really racist. As if what war or immigration law or whatever, I mean, historically is not. Rather than seeing our role, I think, as helping the nation state discover some best self it never had, it is, in my opinion, our job to have a posture of informed, anti-racist, anti-oppression suspicion, and to trespass against its claims of legitimacy and normalcy however we can. I think third, and this is final, I think this history is important for understanding how totalizing the impact of racial discourse has been on the social order. We are not simply facing a few bad racists in a more or less positive nation-state system. We are facing a racist nation-state system. And if that wasn't bad enough, this racist nation-state system has implications for a whole host of people beyond people of color. If you think about the institutions that I named throughout the history discussion, passports, borders, interventions in family planning, women being responsible for birthing the sort of future racial supremacists, et cetera, it becomes clearer that the racist nation state only benefits a tiny elite group consisting of white, heterosexual, wealthy or well-off, virile males who are natural citizens. That's a very small group of people. So all women, men of color, individuals with alternative sexualities, the poor, suffering, people suffering from addictions, the elderly, children, I would add as my vegan anarchist self, non-human animals and the rest of creation, all of those massive other categories are vulnerable to the nation state, if not outright oppressed. And so my personal dream in closing is to see such a system resisted at least and dismantled at best, not because I didn't create it and think that I can make something better all by myself, but because the nation state is still geared toward too many people's annihilation, myself included. And because I think it is all right to use our creativity to envision something beyond the destructive power it wields. The nation state, like race, is not some fixed, unalterable biological reality. It has a birthday, and it has a birthing process. And so maybe, just maybe, it's time to join the occupiers in imagining another more liberating way to organize ourselves. Maybe that might just make the already but not yet norm that Jesus has invited into more tangible than it already is. Thank you.
Thank you. Am I wired up?
Yep.
Reminds me of a story of a told in Africa about an Anglican bishop who was going to speak in some ancient little stone chapel that had really bad acoustics. And the technician was trying to wire him up, and they couldn't get the sound right and couldn't get the volume right, and there was all of this technical difficulty. And finally, the technician said to the bishop, "Bishop, you're going to have to talk very, very loud because the agnostics in here are just horrible." So I'm wired up, I guess. Thank you, Nikisha, for that remarkable, incisive, and thought-provoking presentation. It's my distinct pleasure to be a respondent to your work. And as you have organized your thoughts around three major sections, race theorizing, race and nation building, and Christian resistance to racism and the nation state, Likewise, I will configure my remarks around those three nodes of thinking. Let me just say this. As someone who's passionate about Jesus, who's an Anabaptist in persuasion, an ordained pastor, a professor of justice and peace studies, and who carries a big imprint of Africa, 16 years in my life, I will draw from these rich streams as best as I can in some of this deliberation. Nikisha does a brilliant job of systematically building the case for socio-political construction of race over the last few hundred years. Comprehending the conception of race theorizing requires us to understand the critical component of authorship and voice in our efforts to sort through historical narratives and who has the power to set the historical agenda. Michel Trelaw, in his excellent treatise on the near complete erasure of the Haitian Revolution, 1791, from history, develops the notion of history being the production of elaborate sets of both mentions and silences. These mentions and silences are scrupulously mediated by men, and in this case, enlightened white European men of the colonial era, who had the proverbial power of narrative production through the fountain pen of the history at their disposal. For colonial Europe, at the height of its neatly packaged, scientifically categorized worldview of white supremacy, the Haitian Revolution was not only unacceptable, but it was completely unbelievable. The very idea of the African colonial subjects being able to not only design, plan, and implement a mass-based armed mobilization that effectively ousted the French from Haiti was preposterous. Being unwilling to admit this defeat and unable to locate, read here, attach a form of meaning to this outrage, the French colonizers had to come up with another explanation. Inordinate amounts of time were spent in French Parliament in agonizing debate over this historical event, and yet there was no way in which they could create a satisfactory explanation. There was no place to fit this into their enlightened meta-narrative. So they did what we are all apt to do. They decided to expunge the very memory and evidence of this historical legacy through the process of silencing, an act of historical political amnesia. This they did, and it was only in the last few decades that this modern-day revolution, occurring within the same time frame as the American and French revolutions, which we study extensively, is finally being studied and recognized for its incredible significance. It has finally been given its mention. CJP has been privileged to be part of a project called Healing Historical Harms. This is under the program of Coming to the Table and is really looking at finally coming up with a cohesive or coherent framework to try to understand how do we deal with historical trauma and to respond with some kind of rationality to the sort of hysterical responses that we get in this country and many others that say, well, what can we do? That was so far, that was so long ago. You know, let's leave it, this sort of panic. So David Anderson Hooker, Amy Potter Tchaikovsky have authored a manual called Healing Historical Harms, in which they look at trying to understand a little bit of what would it mean to get our minds around these sorts of historical harms that we're talking about here. They give the term traumagenic to this concept. And they take a careful look at what they call legacies, which are the social narratives, attitudes, beliefs, values, and norms of racism or other systems of oppression and violence, and the aftermath, which are the structures, institutions, and legislation built up around those narratives, which have entrenched those historical harms and in which what we feel today. Certainly, the recent book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, is a case in point of looking at the criminal system, our prison industrial complex, and how it has, in fact, left the African-American male approximately at the same level of freedoms as he had in the 1940s and 1950s in this country. While racial theorizing is a very poignant example of contemporary forms of human ranking, this is not a new phenomenon. The use of us, them thinking has been part of, I would propose, the use of us and them thinking has been part of human identity solidification and human organizational and structural consolidation since the beginning of time. social psychologist Vamik Volkan makes the case that this process of collective ordering is founded on what he terms as chosen traumas and chosen glories. These chosen traumas and chosen glories are sort of our way of codifying our patriotic history, amplifying all the trauma committed against us by the other, and glorifying all the virtues of goodness that dwell in us. If we fall into this, which we all do, unfortunately, regularly, we quickly fall into a collective psyche of uniformity, a variation of groupthink that becomes the basis for the existence and extension of the modern state. So now I'll move to the modern state and race. Nikisha makes the case that the nation state is not only, is not something good that went terribly wrong, as our liberal progressive friends would like us to believe. It is in fact a hierarchical structure that is predicated on violence, inherently conflictual, and in this case exclusively racist. It is our Frankenstein. A governance experiment gone wrong, as with all violent structures. It has morphed into an unwieldy structure that has become much more than a sum of its parts. It has a devastating life of its own and an unyielding appetite for power and demand for subservience. It has become our political taskmaster. The modern-day nation-state, and I did my doctoral work in Zimbabwe, and if anyone knows about Zimbabwe, I spent some time on that trying to look at how they developed this violence meta-narrative and hoisted it on a nation and how that nation internalized it. And it became clear to me in that study that the modern-day nation-state has become the formulator of identities, the system of ordering, the defender of exclusion and inclusion, and the tool for political discipline, to borrow from Foucault, and the enforcer of social uniformity. To deal with this predicament, we find ourselves in order to deal with this predicament of the nation state, we have, I think, manufactured a multiplicity of narratives about the state that are meant to soothe, comfort, and subdue us. The nation state has become our imagined community, and for some of us, our beloved community. And I refer now to the story of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. And the juxtaposition to Acts 2, which has already been mentioned by Chris last night, and I don't want to rehash that. I want to take a slightly different look at it and say, while the language is key to the metaphor of these two narratives, my colleague and friend Dr. Nick Rowe from South Africa always points to the silences, that which is not said, in these passages. He asks, who built the Tower of Babel? Who actually labored? Who put in the grunt work to make this happen? It certainly wasn't the royal family, the political elite, or the wealthy financiers of this great endeavor. As would have been the norm then and still is now, the Tower of Babel was most likely built on blood, sweat, and tears and the backs of large enslaved populations, indentured laborers. Therefore, unification of the nation state came at the price of great oppression. And liberation from dependency, development theorists such as Gunder Frank in his World Systems Theory has argued this for decades, that our entire modernist development framework has forced the world into a global system of oppression where the periphery always serves the core. In Acts 2, by contrast, we see the opposite. A spirit-breathed unity amidst diversity, a horizontal networked movement. Andrew Walls, in his book on the spread of Christianity, makes the case that the church has always flourished in the margins. And that as we take a closer look at Christian movements of history, we see a continual trend of the church trying to centralize, trying to pull in and core down, only to die and be rebirthed again at the margins, the peripheral. Certainly Jesus in his Great Commission charge put this ripple effect into motion from Jerusalem, Judea to Samaria to the uttermost parts of the earth. So let me conclude now with Christian resistance to racism in the nation state. I would like to pose that the posture of the church is one of resistance to centralization, or in response to last night's concern that we're not rebels without a cause, dare I say, celebration of decentralization. Hold that in your thoughts for a while. I'm also going to quote William Kavanaugh. He seems to be popular along with some other things. As Chris was talking last night, I was thinking, if he says one more thing, I'm going to have to rewrite my response. William Cavanaugh has an article entitled The Sacrifice of Love, which speaks to the Eucharist, which he loves to do, but this time he concentrates on Paul's use of the metaphor of the body with many parts, the body of Christ. While we tend to sterilize this message and confine it to a simple human anatomy analogy, Paul was in fact using the word quite deliberately and politically. In Paul's time, everyone was aware of the Greek influence and especially the notion of body politic, utilized by the oppressive occupiers of that day in order to enforce their order. So when Paul uses the term body of Christ, it had a double meaning, physical and political, to his listeners. And his listeners understood what it meant. In that environment, the Greek understanding of the body politic, every member of the body is believed to be born into a particular position of life, sort of fatalistic, which of course was structured in a hierarchy of slave and servant women, children, men, elite leaders. Paul said that when we come together to celebrate the body, we implode this rigid social-political ranking structure, a caste system, literally. And in Christ, we come up with something new, neither Greek or Jew, male or female, slave or free. And that's our challenge. So what does this mean for the church to celebrate decentralization? First of all, I take us back to the nation state and my hypothesis that the nation state and what Nakisha said carries the DNA of trauma and its legacies and aftermath in its very structure. So why the church? How does it provide an alternative? And yes, we all know the times the church has completely imitated the mimesis of the church of this, and the hierarchy and the power and all of that. We can all quote those. But I believe the genius of the church is its redemption factor. I'm going to go right back to our simple understanding of redemption. Gathering of transformed people, the concept of new creations in its ideal form, and what I believe the Spirit desires and what happened on Acts 2, was that we were a gathered group of people no longer encumbered by the legacies and aftermath of saturated empirical thinking, empire thinking, and doing of the nation state, and its long arms of oppression and repression. Therefore, I'm convinced that it means we don't need to necessarily embrace anarchy and all of its confusion, or completely embrace the state. I think this dualism is actually not very helpful. I would prefer to wrestle with how do the religious communities of Jesus' day, how did they deal with the relationship of empire? And I'll close with this 1 minute. Dr. David Lim talks about five different religious communities, or four, and then Jesus' example. He talks about the first option of the religious communities in response to their Roman occupiers was collaboration, which is a pragmatism and an expediency. The Sadducees and the Herodians of Jesus' day took this approach. It was a convenient submission in relationship to the Roman invaders. The second option was violent overthrow, which was the Zealots' armed struggle against oppression, the radical left political party of Jesus' day. And interestingly enough, Jesus gathered mostly Zealots in his 12. There were some fishermen and tax collectors, but the majority of them were Zealots. Jesus saw something about the energy that they brought, the passion that they brought into their cause, and he wanted to redirect that. The third option is withdrawal, which was the Essenes, the sort of maintenance of religious life by retreat from society. And the fourth was segregation, the sort of preoccupation with religiosity and the very preoccupation with separating faith and politics. And this was sort of the Pharisees of the day. And I'll quote Robert Mugabe here, who shook his finger at his audience one time and said to the church, "You must do what you're supposed to do, pray and save souls, but do not enter the rigorous mental debate of politics." And I said to the church, if we cannot enter the rigorous mental debate of politics, we have become irrelevant. Option five is a subversive engagement, a self-sacrificial servanthood, even unto death. And this, I believe, is what Jesus modeled to us. What that subversive engagement looks like, I'm not sure. How close can we get to remain relevant but not eating the king's food? As they say in Africa, if your mouth is full of the king's food, it's hard to speak to him. So what is our position? Close enough to be relevant, but far enough away to be prophetic. This is this subversive engagement.